some of how Indy works, give you a picture of that under the covers, but also talks about how interoperability comes into play and the types of decisions we're trying to make here that will lead to the types of changes to Indy that will result from that, so that we've got this interoperability we're after. It'll clarify, hopefully, for everyone what it means when we say that user story that I've put forward as the basis of this conference, and make it clear where it comes into play. Feel free to interrupt me at any time. Richard's watching the chat, and will let me know when anyone's going. When anyone wants to talk, ask questions, or anything like that, feel free to use the chat or just simply start talking. If we get too many, we'll go to the hand raising. But I think for this session, since it's less a discussion where we're making decisions, feel free to just start speaking. So with that, I'll get going. Problem is, there's more than one Indy network. This is a future problem in some ways, because we've got Sovereign as currently still the single major production Indy network, but there's about five or six. We're going to have a session tomorrow covering four of them. There's five or six other networks that are coming into being. There's Findy in Finland. There's Bedrock that IBM is leading. There's the Indicio network. There's ID Union in Germany. So there's a whole series of them for different reasons that are starting up. But right now, when you use an Indy network, when you use a mobile agent, you pick the one network that you're going to work with. And as soon as you go back into the network selection and pick another one, anything you collected, any credentials you used off the first network you used, are useless until you switch back to that network. If you interact with another agent that is on that uses a different Indy network, things won't work. And so that's the problem we're trying to solve. It's an existing one today. We've got multiple non-production networks even today. There's three Sovereign networks, and people are doing different things on the different Sovereign networks. BC, government of British Columbia, hosts its own network just as a test network that anyone can use, is wide open to use. So today you have to pick one of them. And tomorrow there's going to be multiple production networks. I said them already, but there they are. There's another list. As well, Canada, the Netherlands, they're also thinking of having their own networks for various reasons. This was the user story that we provided. As a prover, I want to be able to create a proof that includes claims from credentials rooted in different networks that a verifier can verify, so that I can easily interact with users. So let's talk about that. There is a separate issue of multiple non-Indy networks, and that is going to be covered. That is going to be eventually an issue, but right now for this conference, we're not going to focus on that, or at least we're not until we get the Indy one resolved and the questions around that. Why are people using Indy? Why is it proven to be a pretty popular one that 100 people would join a technical discussion about it and how to improve it? Design for identity. It is specifically designed for a verifiable credentials-based solution, so trust over IP. It's relatively simple to deploy, and far easier, I think, from what I've seen, than general purpose ledgers and blockchains. So for example, I went in Phoenix, I went to the introduction to Hyperledger Fabric and went through here's how to spin up a simple local Fabric ledger. And it was pretty complicated. There's a lot of things to do. I can start an Indy node network and be running in literally 3 minutes, depending on how good of a network connection I've got. It is a permission network that allows for a legal system-driven governance. Legal system meaning that people signed legal agreements to become participants, either as hosting nodes, hosting validators, as being able to write to the network directly, or be able to create transactions that get written to the ledger. All of those have the ability to come with legal systems, legal documents around them. So anyone who's become a sovereign steward, has become an endorser on the sovereign network, become an author, you all of those participants have to sign legal agreements. Now, if you use the Be Sovereign one, there are none. It is a test network that has no restrictions on it. And basically anyone can get access to the trustee network. We've even had people add nodes to it because it's so wide open. That does cause problems. But so you can either enforce a bunch of governance on it and use handle things like GDPR and things like that, or you can have basically no governance if you want. So it gives you that range. The other thing is it's not tied to a cryptocurrency, and that's a big deal for some. DIDs and the routing of DIDs can be done in Ethereum and Bitcoin, but that brings on a bunch of other challenges, certainly in a government and a corporate scenario. That often brings a lot of tension with it. As my friend John Jordan always says, he's not going to be the one that has to explain to the Premier of British Columbia that we just bought a bunch of Bitcoin so that we can secure the internet safety of the citizens of British Columbia. That's a hard sell. And so Indy allows us to do it in a different way. Big thing is ZKP support, zero knowledge proofs. When you prove something, you do not, as a holder, as a person who has a credential, you don't expose your ID. You don't have to expose your ID. An identifier about yourself. In any solution where you are given a credential and you present that credential, and you're not using ZKP, you are always providing a unique identifier for yourself that is used to verify the proof. And in Indy and with ZKP support, you don't have to do that. Second, selective disclosure versus the entire credential. So with Indy, you can pick what credentials you give in a proof. You don't have to provide the entire credential. You can even just provide proof that you have the credential. You don't even need to prove anything within the credential other than you have it. There's also the idea of predicates. Prove a condition without revealing the underlying data. So this is the walk in the bar and proof that you're old enough to drink. You can do that based on your date of birth in a credential, but without exposing your date of birth. And then finally, ZKP revocation. Revocation is crucially important. We're finding in the use cases we're doing, it's absolutely necessary that revocation be supported. But if you're going to support ZKPs, your revocation has to be ZKP as well. Sorry about that. I think I have some sort of nervous condition that causes me to need to cough as soon as I start to speak in public. It's a fun thing. ZKP support for revocation is crucial. A classic way to do revocation is you have each credential has a revocation ID associated with it. And to prove your credential's not been revoked, you give the verifier your revocation ID and they can check that it hasn't been revoked. But that immediately is a unique identifier for you. So that defeats the whole idea of not exposing an ID. So in order to use ZKPs with revocation, you need a ZKP revocation. And then the final reason for using Indy is it's a solid and complete implementation. We started using it 3 years ago. It has improved and evolved, but fundamentally has not changed. It is a solid and complete implementation that we can do serious use cases with. So that's the background of why people are interested, probably why you're here. Excuse me. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about what happens on the ledger and where interoperability comes in. So we're getting into some of the technical pieces. That was more around governance and things like that. Now it's into the technical pieces. So I have an Indy ledger here and I have an issuer. And now I'm going to go through the activities that an issuer has to do in order to issue a verifiable credential. So as an issuer agent, first thing I have to do is I have to put a DID on the ledger. So I have to write it, create a DID for myself and write it to the ledger. Once I have that, I may or may not have to write a schema. So a schema is simply a list of the claims, the attributes of a credential that I want to issue. Now, if the schema already exists on the ledger, somebody else wrote it and we're trying to use a common schema, I don't have to write it as an issuer, or if I'm the first one or I'm creating something that's unique, I do have to write that. So after I create my DID, I may or may not create a schema. Next thing is a credential definition. So a credential definition is required in order to issue credentials. And it has a pointer to the schema that you're using so that there's a structure, a list of claims within that credential. And it also points back to the DID that I created, because that is the thing that allows a verifier to know who issued the credential that they're verifying. So DID, schema, and credential def. The other thing the credential definition contains, and this is important for part of what I'll talk about later, is it contains a set of private keys, a set of key pairs. The credential definition itself that goes to the ledger contains the public keys for there is one public key per attribute in the schema. And so that's the mechanism that is used to sign each of the individual credentials so that you can A, do selective disclosure. You can just expose the one claim, and B, so that the verifier can verify that there's been no tampering by the holder of the credentials within it. So we've got a credential definition. It points to the schema to tell us what the claims are, and it also points to the DID of the issuer. And it also contains a set of public keys that are used when signing a credential to give to the holder. Okay? And then if you're going to support revocation, you're going to have one or more revocation registries. A revocation registry is created. A first one would be created at the time you want to start issuing credentials, and it contains a finite number, say 10,000, space for 10,000 credentials. That means that you can issue 10,000 credentials with that revocation registry, and then once you finish that, you need to create another one. That'll give you 10,000 more, and so on. So you can have an unlimited number of credentials that you issue, but if you're going to have revocation, you need a registry with an identifier for each credential that you issue. It's using that you revoke credentials. And we'll talk about that in a bit. So as an issuer agent, I've done all those things. And so now we can move on to what a holder and prover does. So at this point, I'm an issuer and I'm ready to issue credentials, and I've contacted in some way some holder, and that holder wants a credential from me. So the first thing I do is back and forth, I issue a credential to that holder. The holder is going to give me is going to use what's called a blinded leak secret. And I'm going to embed that in the credential. And this is the mechanism that allows the holder to prove the credential without having to prove that they have information about that credential that only the holder could have. I'm not going to go deeply into that, but it's that it's the third of the four pieces of or this. I always do that as the second. So when you prove a credential, you're proving four things. One, who issued the credential, and you can do that because you know the DID that issued the credential, the DID of the issuer, who holds the credential, that it was issued to the holder, and that's because they're able to prove that they have a secret that they don't expose to you, but they prove to you that they have it about the credential. The third is it hasn't been tampered with, that none of the data within the credential has been tampered with. Well, that comes back to the keys, the public keys that are in the credential definition. And the fourth is that it's not been revoked. And that comes back to the revocation registry. So I've issued a credential. From time to time, I'm going to issue lots of credentials to lots of people, and I'm going to want to revoke them either one at a time or perhaps in batch. Maybe daily, I'm going to revoke a bunch of them. Missed a step. Sorry. In receiving this credential and in doing the back and forth, I'm going to have to go to the ledger as the holder to read the schema and the credential definition. So I'm going to have to get at least that. I may have to get the DID. I can't remember if exactly I have to, but credential definition kind of exposes the DID to me. So I don't think I need that. The DID is just so that I can prove which it is. But those are used in the holder. So the credential went into the storage. The holder put the credential in storage. The holder would probably also cache the schema and the credential definition. Notice that the holder has not written anything to the ledger. They haven't written a DID, they haven't written this or anything. And that is expected. Only in the common indie world, as it's been used up till now, only the issuer is writing to the ledger. All the other actors, the holder prover and the verifier, are just reading from it. Now, I've issued a bunch of credentials. I want to revoke some of them. The way I do that is I write a revocation entry, and I do that every time I want to revoke one or more credentials. And basically that updates public information to say that certain credentials have been revoked. I may be revoking this one. I may not be revoking this one. It's whatever ones that I need to revoke. I write as entries. Each revocation entry points back to a revocation registry. Each revocation registry points back to a credential definition. So everything's linked in here. In issuing the credential, one of the things that I put into it, one of the things that I tell the holder is the ID within the revocation registry of that credential. And the holder knows that, the issuer knows that. And the holder's going to use that to figure out when they go to prove their credential, whether it's been revoked or not. Am I making sense so far? Any questions at this point?
No questions in chat so far.
All right. The pace okay for folks? All right. Okay. So at this point, the issuer has written a bunch of things. They've issued a credential to the holder prover. They've issued a bunch of credentials to others. They may have revoked some of them. So they've got all of these items on the ledger. So the holder suddenly receives a proof request from someone, a verifier. The proof request contains information that says, hey, I want you to prove one or more credentials. And the holder is going to take a look, and they're going to look in their storage to figure out what credentials satisfy that proof request. It could be multiple credentials satisfy it because they can use any of them, or it might be requesting The proof might cross over multiple credentials, and so prove those. So they do that. They construct a proof. They have the schema and the credential definition, so they need to look at those, and then they construct a proof and send it over. And that is the work of a prover. Question about the difference between a schema and a cred def. So a schema is simply a list of names of claims. If it's a driver's license, it's the driver's license number, the name of the person, the color of their eyes, their height, their class of driver's license that they hold. The credential definition points to that, has a pointer to that, but doesn't, that the schema that's on the ledger has a pointer to the DID of the issuer, so it is specific to the issuer, and it contains key pairs of the public keys for one public key for each claim, each attribute within the schema. So one for the driver's license number, one for the color of the skin and so on, or color of the eyes and so on, color of the skin. That is just a wrong thing to say. Okay. Proof. So that creates a proof. In reply to a proof. So that's the activities of the holder prover. Now we look at the verifier. The verifier has no contact with the issuer, or need not have any contact with the issuer. So the issuer is out of the picture. The verifier doesn't have anything on the ledger that they're looking at. They send a proof request off to a holder prover, the reverse of what we saw earlier. And at some point later, they get back a proof. And that proof contains signed pieces of data plus references to the credential definitions to which those data elements are connected. So now that you have a proof and it's got a bunch of references to credential definitions, you're going to read in those credential definitions. I missed a step in the last, but anyway, we'll not worry about it. They're going to read in a bunch of credential definitions. Optionally, if it's a revocable credential, they also have to read the revocation entries. Let me go back. Yeah, I missed this dotted line here. So I'm just going to finish this off. In constructing a proof, the holder must access the set of revocations that have occurred, the full set of entries, to verify that their credential, their specific credential that they hold, has not been revoked. So in addition to the schema and the credential definition that the holder gets, in constructing a proof, they also have to collect the revocation entries that have been created and use that in constructing the proof. So coming back over here, the verifier, when it receives a proof, can look up the credential definitions that are included in the proof. And then if any of them are revocable, they too must go to the ledger and pick up the revocation entries so they can verify the proof that it is indeed not revoked. And that's basically all that a verifier agent needs to do to verify that the credential, that the proof is a valid proof. They might also, from the cred def, figure out the DID and go to the ledger to figure out who the issuer is. So if they already know about all the DIDs of issuers of credentials they accept, for example, perhaps they only accept driver's licenses and they only do it from a set of predefined DIDs, then they don't need to go to the ledger. They just look up in their local list, what DIDs do I accept? Do I accept the proof that I've got? But if I've never heard of this, suppose they're receiving credentials from students from universities around the world, they may never have heard of a certain issuer of a credential, and so they might have to investigate what DID issued that, what entity is associated with that DID. So they may have to go get the information about the DID and then use that to figure out who the issuer of that credential was. So we've covered the activities of the issuer, they write a bunch of things to the ledger. The activities of the holder prover, who receives a credential from the issuer and collects some data to verify that, you know, to make sure that's a valid credential, and then finally, and construct a proof from it. And finally, they we've looked at the verifier and what the verifier has to do in order to verify a proof, which is get some things off the ledger, compare that, and use that as information to verify the proof. The verifier doesn't talk to the issuer. They only talk to the prover. They may talk to the issuer to find out who they are, to decide if they want to trust that issuer, but they do not have to talk to the issuer in order to verify the proof. They do that verification of the proof by looking at the data that the issuer wrote to the ledger. Make sense?
Victor asks if a verified claim is the same as a verified credential.
A claim is a data element within a credential. So a verified claim is a single attribute of a credential. So a credential is simply a collection of claims. Does that make sense? So that's why the terms get confusing. Originally, we talked a lot about in the W3C community as it established these, they used the term claim a lot. And then a claim is a collection of claims is a credential that you would issue as a single unit. Okay, I just wanted to lay that foundation and figuring that there would be a few people that are relatively new to this and wanted to understand that, because this leads us to the conversations of, okay, why is interoperability a problem? So with all of that foundation, I'm now getting to the crux of it, which is, why is it a problem? Ah, I missed my check mark. Shoot. Once the verifier approves it, collects all this data, and they look at the proof and they compare the data, they can verify that the proof is indeed valid and they can accept it. Okay. Today, ledger resolution happens in the following way. Basically, configuration data that is used, that is loaded into the verifier agent at the start of the verifier's, as it is deployed, as it is activated, it reads some static configuration data. And when it gets a credential definition or a schema or a revocation registry, it uses that configuration data to find the genesis file for the network, the Indy Ledger network that it knows about, and then it calls the Indy Ledger based on the information in that file. So basically, at the time the verifier agent starts up, it reads some static data. When it reads a credential definition, it says, oh, I gotta go, or when it reads a proof, for example, it says, oh, I need to go get a credential definition. So it uses the static data it has, which tells it where a genesis file is. It uses that genesis file, which points to a particular ledger. It's the genesis, the beginning of that ledger. And so it points to that ledger. That's basically it. Yeah.
Quick question on the last topic.
Okay, sure.
Can you verify individual claims within the credential?
Yes. The term selective disclosure is what that means. So certain models of verified credential models, in those you are issued a credential and the entire credential is signed. And therefore, in order to prove it, you prove the entire credential and all the claims within it. What Indy provides, that because the credential definition contains a set of public keys, one per claim, you are able to selectively choose which claims you want to prove. And so you can selectively prove individual ones. Indy also has a capability that it encodes the claims. So you can prove either the raw value, the actual data element, or you can just prove that you have the data element and prove the encoded version. So what that means is without revealing the value of the credential, you can prove that you have, or sorry, the claim, you can prove that you have it. So that's what's, so that is what is selective disclosure. So that's what that term means. You're only proving individual claims within a credential.
So that explains the flexibility that the holder has when they're fulfilling the proof request. Can a verifier request just a specific claim, or do you have to have a different cred def for that?
So in the proof request that the verifier sends out, they say, I want you to prove these individual claims. So they can pick which claims they want you to prove. So they can be selective at what they want to see. And that request can cross multiple credentials. So they can say, I want you to prove this value from this credential and this value from this credential and this other value from this other credential. And then you would just need to prove those three individual claims. And then as well, there's this ability by the holder, the prover, to expose the value for each of those things they prove. Now, if they don't expose the value, if they just prove they have them without exposing them, the verifier may not accept that from a business purpose, but from a technical cryptographic measure, those are valid. That's a valid proof. They've satisfied the proof. Hopefully that makes sense. Okay. Let's come back to the ledger resolution today. So basically each agent knows about loads in configuration data at startup time. And when they go to resolve something, they have a single Genesis file that they go and use to access. And that points them to a single Indy ledger, and there they find the objects that they want. Assuming that the issuer, the holder, and the verifier are pointing to the same Genesis file and the same Indy ledger, then everything works. If the verifier is configured to look at a different Indy network, they're looking at a different Genesis file and a different Indy ledger. When they receive the proof, they will go look for that credential definition on the Indy file, and they'll find the credential definition is not there. They're not able to verify the proof. The configuration data could contain different Genesis files, and on a transaction by transaction basis, they could point to a different Genesis file and hence a different Indy ledger, but they can't do that within a single transaction. And that's the nub of the problem we've got here. If they're gonna go verify a proof, the code, the Indy code, the Indy SDK cannot receive that proof, have a bunch of credential definitions in it, and do anything other than look them up on a single Indy ledger. They can't have it look up on different Indy ledgers. I see we've got another selective disclosure. selective disclosure is it's with any schema on Indy. You can do that with anything. It's not part of a specific implementation. It's specific to things that support selective disclosure, which is a style, it depends on the style of the verifiable credential you're using. Okay, so that's ledger resolution today. Let me go back to Indy Interop and what we're trying to achieve. So basically I have the same picture as before. I've got my verifier agent, I've got my storage, I've got my ledger, I've sent out a proof request, I've got this proof back, and now I want to, I see in the proof, I've got a bunch of credential definitions, so I need to go read those credential definitions, and I need to read those entries off the ledger. We start again with some config data, but I'm going to tell you what, why it's a little different than before, but basically it consists of information about some ledgers. And now I just changed this entire section, which is when I've written to the ledger, I've changed from having a did to having an n colon did, namespace did. I've got a schema, now I've got an n colon schema, namespace. So basically what I've got is I've expanded the identifiers that are used to identify the credential definition, the rev registry, the schema, and so on, to include a network identifier. So basically all I've done is stuck a string in front of each of these objects that tells me what network this is on. Then I resolve that prefix that tells me what network that is, which in turn tells me where I can find the genesis file for network N, which in turn tells me where network N is in the world. So there is your, that at its at its minimum is what this whole conference is intended to solve. In the old way, we just had these things have implied to be from the Indy ledger, the one that you know about. And it's implied that the verifier agent knows which network it is and where it's supposed to be. Basically, in the beginning, there was going to be the sovereign network and that was it. And as we've learned, that's not going to work. And so what we've got to do is add on a mechanism that allows us to have multiple, have identifiers in all of these objects that are written to the ledger or managed by the agent that has an identifier for the network on which this object resides, so that when it goes to resolve it, it is figures out based on that prefix which network it is, therefore which genesis file it needs to go to, therefore how to find the ledger. Does that make sense?
What is the role of a universal resolver and a did method?
A universal resolver is basically this piece that allows us to, based on a prefix of the did, be able to tell us how to find out in the world where the network is. And so this is a form of universal resolver. In this case, this is an Indy resolver. A Indy resolver, and then a universal resolver uses did methods, and did methods basically say, in order to resolve a did and find the value of the did doc in order to look out in the world, the did method defines how to resolve it, how to find a pointer to the network. In the Indy world, it's always a genesis file. In other networks, it's a different thing. And therefore, how to find the ledger to find the object that we're looking for. So if I go to read a did, I can pass the identifier, the did identifier, the string did colon blah, 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 to a resolver. The resolver will say, hey, that's over on this other network. It'll do all the calculations and then return the value of the did. So that's what the universal resolver does. The way it does it is it looks at the did method, the second part, the part after did colon, to figure out what did method is used and then therefore how it interprets it to be able to find the ledger.
Is a resolver another node type?
It is not, it's certainly not the same as an Indy node. It is another component that can be either embedded in your verifier or can be an external resource used by your verifier. One of the challenges with it is the universal resolver itself that is out there, the thing called the universal resolver at uniresolver.io is a centralized single resolve component. So it sort of uses this decentralized concept, but it is a centralized thing.
Hey, so it's usually a web service that you can query from your application to find out where something's rooted.
How do you register a new network? That is the second discussion on the primary track. So I'm going to talk about now what the primary track is and what we're going to be talking about, but that actually is exactly the topic of the second primary track session today. Good question, Marty. Okay. So hopefully that makes sense as to what the problem is. Summarizing holder prover and verifier, they read objects. What we want to allow, holder prover and verifier have the same requirements. They read objects from resolve networks. What we want to do is allow multi-select on networks. So instead of having a single check mark and we can only have one check mark active at a time, we want to be able to have check boxes and be able to select multiple, so that whenever we get a reference that talks about the sovereign network or the sovereign staging network, we can recognize an object that it's one of these, and we can resolve it as we go. When I talked about in the previous one that there's some config information in the previous slide, there's some config information. What this config information now would say, oh, I already know about these five networks. I know about Findy, and I know about Bedrock, and I know about Sovereign. And so I'm going to allow, I'm going to check those ones off, but I know about the B Sovereign test, but I don't want you to use it. So I'm not going to allow using it. So that is pre-configured. You may know about a set of them, and you may decide based on their governance framework, whether you trust them, whether you're going to allow interactions with them. And then there's the question of what happens when you come across a network that you've never heard of before. So you get a proof from somebody and it's got sovereign, it's not from any of these, but it's from this new Indicio test network. Do I want to accept a value from that? Now you've got to decide as an application, what are your business rules around that? Do you accept any indie network and you just go process it so it gets added to the list automatically with a check mark? Or do you want to go ask the user, hey, you got this, this issuer offered you a credential, but they issued it, they're offering it from this network I've never heard of. Do you want to allow that to happen? Do you want to accept this and interact with it? So that's what dynamically adding networks means. Holder prover and verifier are the same. Issuer is slightly different. Issuers write objects. They generally don't write to multiple networks. They choose what network they're going to use. A Finnish company will choose Findy. And so when they issue a credential, they're going to issue it on Findy. For now, I'll say you can't write the same objects to multiple networks. I'm going to leave that. I'm actually going to open that question later, but for now we're saying, as far as we're planning, an issuer would only write a credential rooted in a single network. And therefore it's only the provers that wind up with this, holder provers and verifiers that wind up with this issue of they get a piece of data, a credential or a proof that they receive, and they have to decide if they're willing to resolve and look up data on different networks.
When we were talking about resolving a network, what safeguards prevent one network from pretending to be another network?
That's going to be in the method that's used to resolve the DID method and how you find the network. So that's going to be taken care of in that. I'll give you an example of one idea that was proposed was that I'm going to get to that in a little later, and I'll mention that when I get to it. The posing is another network. I'll get to that and talk about that in a subsequent slide. Okay. So the goal of Indie Interop, this is, we now understand why we're doing this. We want to add namespace networks and we don't want to break existing implementations. We kind of want to fix the plane while we're flying in the air. This was the best picture I could find to use that one. I kind of like it. So we've got our plane flying and we need to adjust things and fix it while we're in mid-flight without breaking everything. That's the goal of this conference. So now you know. So now I'm going to run through the primary tracks and why these matter and sort of take you through the steps that we're going to get through, the expected steps that are going to get us through that. And then I'm going to talk about the certain secondary track sessions and why they could affect how the rest of this goes. This is kind of how we expect it to happen. So the first session that's going on right now, one Indie did method to rule them all. Currently, the only did method that is defined is this. Did colon solve colon and then an identifier. And it's insufficient because it doesn't tell me what Indie network this is. You could interpret this to say, oh, this means that sovereign mainnet. But what that means is nobody can use this method for any other network. So clearly this is not going to work. And so this is what we're trying to in this conference overcome. So one approach is you namespace the identifier. You take this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and you break it down into network namespaces. So you have did, you have an identifier, and then you break down the, and that actually looks like this. So we've got our did designator, did. We've got our did method. I'm going to change the name from did solve to did indie. Then I'm going to have a namespace here, findy. And then I'm going to have the identifier, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the unique ID within this namespace. So what that says is I'm changing what it looks like to have a new method called did indie. I'm going to define did indie such that the identifier for the did method includes a namespace indicator and a colon, and then the rest of it is the identifier. Now, coming back to this question of further, how do you register a new network? How do you not pose as another? So that is the second topic, but I'm going to use this picture here to show this. So one idea to do this is this string here, this identifier, is a DNS domain, findy.fi. And a way you can register a network is you go to the findy.fi/well-known URL, http findy.fi/well-known/indie, and it contains information about how to find the Genesis file and so on. So if you can trust the DNS system and that mechanism, this could be the way that you A, find the metadata. So that could be the method that you use to find where the Genesis file is. And it's a way to prevent others from posing as the network because you embed that. Now that's only one solution. And this actually, this use of the colon findy colon is only one option for doing that. This is this is the topic that's going on right now in the other Zoom room. The other currently talked about option is what's called an abstract did method. So we define did indie as a full did method. It's basically the same as did solve, more or less. It's a more complete version, but there's never a network called actual did indie. Did findy looks like this, it resolves like this. It's named as a proper did, but it basically uses, if you remember C code, hash include did indie. So it contains the same definition of what the did indie method is, but it then extends that to include the specific data about the location of the Genesis file and other things like that. So In this one, you don't see did Indy, you see did Findy and did Bedrock and did Sov and did Indicio and so on. So each one is a top level defined did method, but underneath the did method, it simply says, hey, everything that you see in the did Indy method, use that. And then here's how to find the specific things related to Findy, the overrides. And of course, the most important override is how do you find the Genesis file for it? So that's a second option. That's what's being discussed in the one did Indy method to rule them all. Question about how do you deal with subnetworks like test dev? They would be a did in this new one, they would be a did method for each of them. Yes, and that becomes very tricky. One of the things that we want to talk about in this is how do you have did localhost? How do you run a local network as a developer and be able to have did localhost as a way to do that and find it? So that's another question. So those are exactly what you're raising on. It is exactly the questions that are being discussed and hopefully decided in the one did method to rule them all. Okay, second one, finding Indy network metadata. I've talked, this has come up several times. So given a did method resolution scheme, how do I find the network metadata? The Genesis file, perhaps, and ideally a machine readable governance framework. If I'm a, first of all, you just need technically, how do you find the Genesis file and therefore how do you find the network? And then second, if you are a user and you've been offered a credential rooted in this other network that you've never heard of, how does your agent give you enough information to decide if you want to trust that network, if you want to make use of it? So there's the purely technical, how do you find the Genesis file? And then the human side of it, which is how do you tell it about the governance framework of that network? How does it know and give you reliable information as to whether you want to allow yourself to be issued a credential from that? The risk is probably pretty low because there's not much a credential can do. But then again, I suppose when we think about it, we also thought that getting a attachment of a picture in an email was harmless. And yet that is one exploit that happens. So basically any extra access that we allow introduces some degree of risk. Could be very, very minor, but a vulnerability could be discovered that gets exploited. So that's the second session. So after we figure out the did method and how we're going to deal with the did method and what it's going to look like, which of these two choices will be used, and if we use this one, what this means, we figure out how to find the network metadata. It could be a combined discussion. We'll see how that goes. Now that you've got this, now we're getting into coding level things. Currently, you have Indy Node, which is the code that operates a network, and you have the Indy SDK, the code that gets embedded in an agent that interacts with the network. On an individual Indy node, do we have to have a network reference? Do we have to change the definition of all of the objects on that to insert an implied the network on which it resolves? Is there significant change needed in Indy node, the code base Indy node, to put in references to objects? And then the second is, you absolutely have to do that in Indy SDK. We're certain of that. And therefore, how are we gonna get that done? What has to change and what is the approach we wanna take, the general approach we wanna take to making those changes? A credential definition, for example. So, or a proof certainly has to contain references to credential definitions, and therefore it has to contain extended, what we now consider extended references to those. It includes both what credential definition we care about, but also on what network does that credential definition reside. This is an example of what a credential definition looks like. It contains what amounts to a DID and another DID. One DID is the credential, the entity that created the credential definition. The other is the entity that created the schema that is related to the credential definition. So you've got two DIDs in here. These could both become altered to become DID references. So they would, instead of just being a identifier, would be DID colon, blah, 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 colon, and then this identifier. That is likely the solution. Who knows? As I'm sitting here thinking about it, what else could it be? I don't know. But basically, that's the type of thing that's going to be discussed in the IndyDID ledger object data references. Once we have the objects themselves, we have to store these objects. An agent has the Indy SDK includes a component called the Indy wallet, and that's the storage layer for Indy. But we've also determined that although it's in the Indy SDK, it really ought to be at the Aries layer. It ought to be independent of Indy and able to store Indy storage, Indy objects, but it also should be able to store other objects from other ledgers. So it's really an Aries component. How does that affect things? How do we want to change how we're storing storing these items? Then we get to what changes do we want to make and where. So what we're trying to do here is make a set of changes that will be used in the future for hopefully a fairly long time. The Indy SDK is currently in the process of being broken up, and we'd ideally like to move to a new structure that puts, for example, the storage, what the component called Indy wallet that is within the Indy SDK. We want to take it out of the Indy SDK and make storage a thing that is at the Aries level. So if we're going to make these changes, what components are we going to change? Are we going to change the Indy SDK? Are we going to change the future of the Indy SDK? Or are we going to, and how is this going to affect Aries frameworks that integrate with the Indy SDK? I'm going to go before I answer the questions that are online so give me a second. Who will make the changes? That's the final session, which is where we try to get commitments from teams to contribute developers and to agree to make all these changes. Andre is going to talk about the Decentralized Hyperledger Indy Development Alliance, which is a moral agreement, not with the strength of, you know, just a moral agreement that you, that this organization is willing to commit these many developers for this amount of time. And so what we'd like to do is get a bunch of people signed up so that we have a set of resources willing to work on making these changes. And then that will lead us to those who contribute to that will lead us to who will make the changes. So that is the entire set of primary sessions that are going to happen. And hopefully we will have mission accomplished at the end of that. Who knows? We'll see. Some of those seem pretty easy. Those last two, what changes are we going to make and how, is going to be a little bit tricky. How would we address, Robert asks, how would we address the problem of having DidSolve get schema from Findy and issue a credential for that DidSolve on Lissy? I think that is basically the same problem. As long as we independently include an identifier for every object, then regardless of where, when we go to get the objects, we can get them from any network. So in theory, a schema could be put on Findy, and a person could use Lissy to issue the credential. So the credential definition is on Lissy, but it references a schema that is on Findy. That should work based on what we're talking about, because each individual object would be retrieved independent of the network that it resides on. And so the schema is an object, and the credential definition is an object, and the fact that they are on two different networks should not matter. There's my hope.
Stephen, if I may extend that a little bit. So, because my understanding is that currently, if I'm creating a schema on Indy, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of belongs to me, right? I mean, nobody knows about that schema created by me, and currently they are not able to reference that schema to issue their own credential definition. At least No, that's not right.
There is no discovery mechanism built into Indy Node to find schemas. You have to know about them. But if you know about them, you can use them for your own.
So basically, as soon as you know the unique identifier of the schema, you can reuse them to basically create credential definition. But there is no discovery mechanism to actually achieve that.
Yeah. So things like Indy Scan and any Indy Ledger browser can give you a list of all of the schema, for example. And so there's no way to ask an Indy node instance. You can't ask the Indy network, hey, tell me where all the schemas are. You have to actually load all the individual transactions and then put them in a database to make them searchable or something like that.
Right. Okay. And then by having the unique identifier of those objects across the networks, you basically can use that mechanism to link the objects and accomplish the use case, which was described in chat.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Cool. Any other questions? I'm going to switch over to the secondary tracks and why they matter.
Hi, can I ask something, Nicola?
Sure. Yeah.
So, well, resolving actually the schemas and the credential definition is very use case and workflow specific, meaning that if I want you to prove me that you have a valid driver's license, I then need to somehow get that information, assuming I don't already have it dynamically, from something that maybe could be included within your proof. Meaning we could have maybe something like the following. We could use the DNS system as a proof and make maybe some text entries there where we say, okay, the authority that issues driver's licenses in the US makes under its official domain name some text entries giving some information with regards to which Indy networks they are committing to publish their credentials. They also have their credential definitions and schemas and so on. And well, as a prover, when I receive this information from somebody that holds these credentials with a proof as part of the proof, I can say, well, all right, you claim that you have a valid driver's license that is issued from the US, whatever department of is issuing driver's licenses. I can resolve it. I can accept that, okay, this is the official website with the official domain name. I can get the text entries from there, which contain the Indy identifiers for the given network. And since I can trust the DNS network and I can trust that this is the official URL for the given organization, and through the control of the DNS entries that they own, they commit that they will be issuing credentials on the given network, then I can well, fairly well trust this information in order to validate the claim made from the holder of the credentials or not.
Yep.
Would that make sense? And would that be something that could work?
Yes. And that is one of the ideas that's being proposed as to how you find the metadata. Yeah, you tie it to the DNS, you tie it to a known entry in the DNS or the dot well-known URL, something like that. Yes, that is exactly right. That is one possible solution. And you are absolutely ready to jump into the primary track conversations because you have good ideas.
But I mean, from my perspective, that would even enable organizations to, especially if you put it into the DNS entries, which means you don't even need to have a web server.
Yeah.
You just have a domain name. It's
exactly
there. And you can even include multiple resolvers saying that, for example, I work for Fujitsu. If I need to prove you that I'm indeed an employee of Fujitsu, you can look up the information I'm giving you as part of my proof. Then Fujitsu maybe participates in several networks for different use cases, for different reasons, whatever, it doesn't matter. But as long as the issuer is committing that under the given network is issuing credentials for employees, then you can be fairly sure that you can accept it and verify my claims, right?
Yep. Okay. I'm going to have to move on because I want to cover a couple of things here and we're running out of time. I believe I've only got 5 minutes, 3 minutes left. Okay, why the secondary tracks matter? Let me jump to that real quickly. Nicholas, when you said you can almost trust it because you can almost trust DNS pretty soundly, Carrie provides a way of getting past that. And that's why Carrie is important. Carrie talks about non-ledger-based self-certifying identifiers. Carry is key event receipt infrastructure. It basically allows you to create an identifier locally and keep a chain of events relating to that identifier. It's things you do with the identifier and key rotations you make with that identifier. You track those as a chain, as a typical blockchain, but only you construct it. But it must be constructed with cryptographically sound data. And then optionally, you publish the chain or a way to get to the chain via a witness. And the witness is a ledger. The chain itself is self-certifying, and so it can be verified to be constant. There are rules for how you start a chain, and there's rules for how you extend a chain. And so that cryptographically, you can verify that the chain that you are being presented is correct and sound, and it also proves who controls it because it contains public keys and things like that. The identifier can be the same on any ledger, and that allows control over the identifier value, but it also means that we could have the same identifier on all indie networks. And so this is a significant thing. The chain is not on the ledger itself. The only thing that's on the ledger might be the identifier, which has a way to find the chain that you can verify. So the ledger is a way to publish information about how to find the identifier and the information behind it. This image, and if you haven't done Carry 101, I highly recommend it. There's a SSI meetup. But basically, this is the domain system, and it's got these two weaknesses to it in relating the identifier to the key pair behind it and to the entity that controls it. With Carry, you get strength in all of them. They're all cryptographically secure, which is better than the DNS system. So that's just a very quick overview. Sam's going to talk about what if an indie network used Carry identifiers as a witness instead of using its own identifiers, these various things that we identify on it. So that's what Sam's gonna talk about. This is the second one I wanted people to be aware of. BBS Plus is a new signature scheme that allows for JSON LD-based ZKPs and revocation. And this is what Mike Lauder is going to talk about. So basically what it means is you have off-ledger JSON LD instead of schema, and you still get ZKP functionality, including selective disclosure. Coming soon, and what Mike's going to talk about a bunch, is revocation and how ZKP revocation is done. You may or may not get predicates with this, depending on how much people want to support that. So the predicates, like being able to prove you're older than 18 without exposing your date of birth, those may or may not be supported. And it gives alignment with other JSON LD-based VC models. So JSON LD is very popular in other communities for VCs because of this idea that the schema information is off the ledger and is common, making it really easy to do what Robert was talking about before, of getting the schema from different places and being able to reference it. What it does is it basically means these two objects, the second part is the way that JSON or BBS Plus constructs the public keys to sign each individual claim eliminates the need for the public keys in the credential definition, which allows us to eliminate the credential definition entirely. So basically we get rid of these two things. We have a DID still, we still need the DID, and we need the revocation information. We still need those, but we eliminate two of the key objects on an indie network. Mike's gonna talk about the impact of, what is the impact of BBS Plus on indie? Less objects to write, obviously. You don't need to write a schema, you don't need to write a credential definition. Instead, you use JSON LD to find that information, the schema information, and then you use the BBS Plus technique to sign individual claims within a credential. He's also going to talk a bunch about some work he's been doing on revocation that will expand out the use of ZKP's revocation. So currently, remember, he's already talked about it, but he's got a document about it. He's going to propose a way to do that with a document. It's not necessarily required, but it is a really nice change in link of what we have. There will be a session on the new indie networks tomorrow. So four of the new indie networks are going to talk about where they are, what their reason of existence is, who their target issues are, what governance structure they have, and so on. So there'll be a few minutes on each of those. And that's all. And I was thinking I was gonna finish this long early and haven't asked me anything, but we're done. So with that, we have to leave and get ready for the next session. So Carrie is next on the secondary session. Fascinating, but you probably need to know about Carrie a little bit before you join that one. The other is the primary track session, where we can learn about what's been decided about one DID method to rule them all, and we can start to learn about how we're going to resolve, based on that DID method technique, how we're going to find Genesis files and governance governance frameworks. And thank you all.
I put a link to the SSI meetup session on Carrie in the notes.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks all.